All right. Hello and welcome to Damon Patch Podcast. I don't know if we started this early in a forever.
We haven't, like I said, we haven't had a Lawrence Calamity to regale us with.
I'm your host, Ryan Johnson. Tim Spence is here.
The only co-host for once. Have we ever had an episode where it was just the two of us?
I've recorded before because Matt gave me his credentials for Zoom.
I think there was maybe only like one other time. But
that might have been with Adriano, though.
Oh, okay.
This might have been the first time with just both of us. So thank you for joining me, Tim.
I'm here. I'm ready to talk some gaming news. I mean, there were some pretty big stories. It'd be a shame not to talk about them.
Big old story, yeah.
Yeah, big old story.
But before we get into that, let's jump into video game fun facts right away. Thank you, Matt, for continuing to provide that information for us. But Tim, take it away.
Thanks, buddy. Yeah, so I'm your interim video game fun fact host for this week. We're talking old school video game updates. So this is something that you and I will remember, but I don't know if everyone who listens to this podcast will remember. The days before certainly consoles and even some computers being able to connect to the internet, and how video game developers would update those games without being able to connect to them, without having the player connect to a server to download an update. So how did game updates work before the days of widespread internet? Before the days of widespread internet, games were primarily distributed on physical media like CDs and floppy disks, meaning that if there were bugs or inefficiencies in the software, once the disks were produced, those bugs and inefficiencies were set in stone to some extent. However, if a significant bug or problem was found after the disks were in the hands of consumers, there were a couple of ways for developers to distribute updates. And there's kind of four main ones here that I can talk about. The first being magazine disks. They were probably the most common distribution method, where gaming magazines would come with disks that contained game demos, gaming content, and also game updates.
Oh my god, I would have never even thought of that.
Magazines used to ship these disks as CDs and even floppy disks. And I remember some of these too. Like, I have a lot of memories of playing like demo discs for the Xbox, and also Xbox games that would ship with demos on the actual game disc. It was a really good way of like cross promoting games between other games at the time. The second major one would be a mail update, which is if a serious bug was discovered, sometimes developers would actually ship out physical discs with patches and fixes to the users that would ask for them. So you had to mail in to the devs and say, I bought this game. It's got this issue that you're aware of. And I saw the announcement that you said that you were aware of this disc and that I could contact you for this physical disc. And then you would provide your shipping address and they would ship you a disc with the update on it. Mm-hmm. And I actually found an image online from Sierra, most notably known for their point and click adventure games back in the days. Mm-hmm. Somebody took a picture of it. It's a Sierra branded first class postage, US postage stamped. And then there's the letter inside that says, Dear Sierra Online customer, please find enclosed the patch or update disc that you requested. For full instructions on updating your game, you can view the README file on the disc. To view this file, 1, insert the disc into your disc drive and make this drive your current directory. For example, if you put the disc in your A drive, type A:Enter. So we're talking command prompt. And then 2, depending on which patch disk you have, you will need to type one of the following commands to view the README file.
Oh my god.
So this is pre like operating system. This is pre-visual operating system. This is pre-Windows. This is pre-Apple.
These are floppies.
These are floppies, right? And then you're punching code into, or not code, but commands into a command prompt.
Mm-hmm.
You can and so it says
that could be Apple II.
Apple II, yep. Type in one of the following commands to view the README file. So fix, enter, or README, enter. You can also view the README file with a text editor or word processor. So they did know that some people at the time did have good enough computers to have word processors. There's no date on this, unfortunately. But anyway, and then it says, if you have any further questions or problems, please feel free to contact technical support at this phone number. You can also contact us directly via fax at this phone number. Or if you prefer, you can write to Sierra Online, P.O. Box 800 in Coarse Gold, California, 93614-0800. And then it says, attention at technical support at the bottom. So that's pretty funny. It's like, not only did you have to take the effort of contacting the developer to get a patch disc, but then you also had to do the legwork of patching it. And that disc likely took a couple of weeks to even get to you after you'd requested it. So, like, that's a lot of investment for updating one game. But at the time, you know?
What I find interesting, though, is how many people were requesting these discs. It's like, why would the developers keep working on the software after it's launched? You know, why would they fix those bugs? And thus, it's just a game. All software is going to have bugs no matter what you do.
Yeah.
Maybe they just figured we better fix this in case people start complaining. You know, and then we have a solution for them and stuff.
I think it was a it was pretty rare that that was something that could happen. And it would have to be a significant enough issue, like that the game was just straight up not playable on certain like computers at the time. Cause this was like building your own computer was really, really, really niche. Like having a home computer was pretty uncommon. Knowing how to build them was really uncommon. So, like, they were just kind of the standard personal computers that you could buy, you know, like pretty standardized devices.
Here's what I'm curious about, though. So, now I could be completely wrong on this. Really old, like, computer games, you would insert a floppy and it would just run the game off the floppy disk.
Yeah.
How do you update that? How does that get updated via an additional floppy with the update on it?
Yeah,
is there something stored somewhere on the computer? Or
I almost wonder, and I'm not a computer engineer, so I don't know. I'm just speculating, but I wonder if it's something like, obviously you're mentioning like, this is sort of like a RAM versus ROM scenario. I wonder if there's like files that you could download to your computer such that when the game is in the RAM, it'll read those files. When it's in the RAM, it would read those files in your computer. And it's like, oh, these are like the updated files. Like I'll pull from this as opposed
that's
to the disk
or so something. Bizarre.
I don't know.
Even when it came to CDs, like games used to run completely on CDs. So that's kind of, I guess, did you install something?
Because I know it on the program, because I remember back in the day watching my brother play computer games on our home computer.
Yeah.
And some of them he would have to install and other ones he wouldn't. So I think it also depends on the software.
Yeah, I think by the time I started gaming, and this was like, you know, mid-90s, on a Performa, an Apple Performa, and like you would be able to see your games on your computer after the disc was taken out.
Yeah.
And so they must have had some sort of install on the computer at that time, because we had hard drives and normal. It was basically a normal computer. By that point.
So that was the second major way that they were distributed. There were also manual PC fixes. So on PCs, changing the odd line of code often wasn't too difficult, obviously. Gaming manuals or magazines would contain instructions on what lines of code to put where to fix problems. So this is like, you've got a problem with your game, like it's not running well, like it's a performance issue kind of thing. And then you're just like buying, you know, PC Gamer back in like 1999. And you're like, oh, dang, there's an article specifically on how to like optimize Doom. To Doom 1.1 or whatever, you know, like it's manual fixes.
That's scary, though, because you could screw something up.
You could, but it does. I think it would often have very like direct instructions, like just do this and don't do anything wrong or anything that's not this. That's kind of just modding now, like writing your own code and then having the game read that. Like that's just modding. And then there were also expansion packs. So. Sounds like a weird phrase to people these days. I don't know what an expansion pack is, but before the term DLC hit the landscape, expansion packs were add-ons to games that added additional content, like a new campaign or maps or skins or whatever. And these were shipped to stores on physical discs. So in addition to this added content, oftentimes expansion packs would also contain patches to fix issues with the base game. And from my personal experience with this, I used to play World of Warcraft back in the day, and that was often, obviously it's a different example because that's an online always game, so you're always going to be able to download updates for patches and things, but you know what's a better example is like The Sims. Anytime there was a Sims content update, expansion pack, like The Sims 2 or whatever, if you didn't have access to the internet, you could buy the expansion packs for The Sims, and then it would often have patches for base game issues. It was funny because you would go online and you'd be like, which expansion pack fixes this issue? And then you can actually find it.
Because there were so many expansions to The Sims. You would just always get the latest update if you kept buying the new ones.
Yeah, exactly. And like, God, Lord knows EA is always keen to put out lots of Sims expansions. And then as sort of a fifth, at the time, experimental update option, telephone line was being experimented with by engineers to transfer data between consoles, and this information could contain updates to fix bugs. However, even though this practice was far from widespread, it did serve as a precursor, obviously, to how we distribute updates today. It's just through the internet. So another sort of major question, obviously, we kind of touched on it a little bit already, but you might be wondering, how did players know when an update was available if it wasn't something that was, they you know, Twitter. Like a widespread issue? Pre-Twitter, pre-social media completely. Without the internet, obviously, players didn't have the luxury of a push notification telling them that a game was receiving an update. So how did they find out? We've already talked about it, but gaming magazines, obviously, naturally distributed on a regular basis for subscribers, like once a month. You got people always going to be able to read about your game. That's a good way to tell people. There's also customer support lines. So back in the day, games actually shipped with manuals, a little leaflet sometimes, or other times an actual full multi-page book. That would have phone numbers in it for customer support. And then customers could call those support lines and then ask about any problems they had. If you're familiar with like the early days of Nintendo Power, Nintendo Power often had cheat codes in the magazines, or you could call, there was actually an official Nintendo player support phone line you could call if you were having issues with a particular level. They could tell you where the secrets were and stuff.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I was watching some documentary on that recently, and I was just like, that's insane that you'd have people who knew the game inside and out.
Paying people to tell people on the phone how to beat a level in a game.
That's insane. Yeah.
Now we call them YouTubers. retail stores, obviously. Sometimes you could go to a game store and they would have information available for customers, or possibly sometimes even the services to update said games in the store. And then there was also a bulletin board system, or a BBS. So tech savvy gamers used to use BBSs to share and distribute information, including game updates. BBSs were an early form of an online community that became prevalent before the internet became widespread. Unlike the workflow of today, where you may go to a website and just download a game's update file, BBSs were hosted on a server. Users could connect via a terminal program and a dial-up modem to upload and download information. They could chat, they could read news, they could read bulletins. It was almost a precursor to like social media, but it was very specifically niche. It's kind of more like I guess you could call it like a Discord server almost. It's like very specific to a particular thing. So some actual real world examples of these things happening. Speaking of Doom before, there was the Doom version 1.1 patch, which addressed several issues, including fixing bugs related to gameplay balance and player progress through levels. Performance was improved, visual glitches were corrected, and crashes and stability issues were corrected to make the game more reliable. Doom version 1.1 was distributed via floppy disk, either through magazine or by phone and mail, and BBS. And Doom was eventually updated several times, leading to the final version of Doom being version 1.9. So,
actually, quite a number of times. Brought to mind my question earlier about why would they continue updating it. It's like, once they sold out their initial batch of discs, they would print new ones, obviously. And so they'd probably want to print ones with the patches on it.
Yeah. Right?
So they would definitely probably keep working on the game, fixing problems, and then distribute newer copies.
You have to keep in mind, too, that like back in the day, there were way fewer games just overall. Like games had a way longer shelf life. Like people aren't picking up a game to play it for a week with their friends and then dropping it for the next thing, right? Like, games had staying power just because there was no competition.
Yeah.
Like it's like, oh, what came out this year? Three games. Well, I don't like that one, so I've got two that I can pick from. Also, they're $150. So you got to save up, right?
Yeah.
I mentioned before as well, Sierra Games, huge developer back in the day, titles like Space Quest and King's Quest. They were known for mailing update desks to consumers that reported issues with their games. And similarly, Apogee Software, who developed Wolfenstein 3D and Doom, provided patches via mail and gaming magazine. And then there was, I think Matt pulled this from a Reddit thread, but there's a game called Raptor Call of the Shadows. The note here says had at least one instance where a disc was sent to a customer that had a computer too new to run it. And I found this comment in a Reddit thread saying, oh yeah, I think I had this game back in the early 2000s and they sent me a disc and my computer was too new to run the game. And I don't know if that's like they shipped a really old version of the game or something, but I don't really know what that means. For a computer to be too new to run a game. But maybe they meant too old.
That might have been before, you know, backwards compatibility kind of things.
Yeah. Things were designed for one build of like a software or operating system.
Even though PCs nowadays can pretty much run a lot of games from the last like 10, 15 years, there are still older games that just you have to find some weird workaround, or you have to install it or get it running in a certain way. It's not just every PC game works on Windows.
Yeah. You know? Sometimes you need to even get like a virtual machine, but just of one particular version of Windows to be able to run this one version of a game. Yeah.
We had issues with the Diablo 1, the first Diablo.
Right.
We had some weird issues trying to get that running.
Glad I joined in for D2. I also found, just in my idle curiosity of this, I found another thread online or on Reddit where somebody asked a number of years ago, when did downloading game updates online start to become the main way developers patched their games? And one person, obviously there's going to be, people are going to remember this differently because a lot of people who game now started gaming with home consoles. Like they didn't have a PC to game with. So a lot of people's memories here is muddy because they're thinking only consoles. But there's one thread within this post where people are talking about specifically online computer games. One person made a good point. They believe the starting point to be digital distribution with platforms like Steam. So could say as early as 2004. Somebody else mentioned remembering downloading updates for the original StarCraft and the original Diablo. And those are like late 90s.
Yeah.
And I was telling you before, Ryan, that I have a personal memory of going to a friend's place where he could play. He was playing Diablo on his parents' personal computer and they had an internet connection. And I remember him downloading updates for Diablo that way. And then similarly with Blizzard, I remember playing Warcraft 2 at that friend's house, and you could play online multiplayer games against other people. And to do that, you had to go online and you would have to download the map from Blizzard's like distribution platform to be able to even play a multiplayer map against people.
Yeah.
And that was sort of more refined for Warcraft 3, where you could just do it straight through the game, which led to like the custom game modes and people making maps and spreading them around that way through hosting lobbies for each other to download the maps. So it's very interesting that even though this wasn't that long ago, like in some cases, not even like maybe 20 years, people have already forgotten a world without game updates,
without the internet being part of gaming.
Yeah Just funny because gaming goes back with home consoles, goes back as far as like the 70s and 80s,
early 70s too, because being that we're looking at some of those before the Atari consoles. Pretty crazy.
So it's always funny to be familiar with something some point in time that people now are forgetting that even happened. Because I found another thread too where it was like, what did game companies do before to update their games before the advent of the internet for internet connectivity? And there were so many replies saying like, oh, they just didn't do it. They shipped a game. They knew it was good when they shipped it out. And it's like you said before, every piece of software has issues. There's not just a single perfect intentional, like everything is intentional piece of software out there. Like everything has issues. But every one of these replies, and this wasn't that long ago, this thread was like 3 years old, and it's people saying it didn't happen. Game devs were perfect back then. Blah 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 blah. Like it's just so many people being so confidently incorrect.
It's because there's this. Obviously, our experience of today is most games ship with. Well, I don't know, maybe most, but a lot of games ship with some major issues at launch, and this happens almost every single game we see. There's some major issue that crops up somewhere. And then they patch it later and then apologize online on their social medias. And then you always hear in the press and stuff or podcasts or just people in conversations saying, oh, yeah, you know, when I had my PS1, you know, the game I just had to play the whole thing. And I don't remember any glitches when I was playing that game. It's like, well, yeah, you forgot about them. You know, you forgot about the bugs or you just missed them. I mean, sometimes you miss a bug, you know. But they definitely shipped with bugs.
Yeah, absolutely. People, like you said before, right? People remember the good times. They don't remember the bad times.
Yeah.
And then I was talking about how, like, people have, even as a more recent example, people have forgotten how rough the launch of The Witcher 3 was. Mm-hmm. Like it was really messy, but everyone remembers The Witcher 3 as just being like the best game ever released and no problems.
Yeah.
And then being surprised when Cyberpunk had a rough launch. It's like, this is not the first time for CD Projekt Red.
We'll see how their next launch is.
Mm-hmm.
What are they doing? Witcher 4 or what are they doing?
They have a number of Witcher projects going right now. I know there's a Witcher 1 remake and then...
Oh, the remake. Yeah.
There's another Witcher project, and I think that's like separate from a sequel. I think it's like a spinoff.
With like Ciri or something?
I can't remember. I don't remember. It was like 2021 or 22 when they made these like three simultaneous announcements. So
yeah,
we only talked about it on the show. You think I'd remember, but.
All right. Well, thank you, Tim. And thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Matt, for collecting that information so that I could read it out in a dramatic radio voice. I didn't do that.
All right, let's hop into the news story. Big news this week, Tim.
Everyone's
talking about it. It's the fall of Xbox.
Oh, it's all over.
It's over. They bought Activision Blizzard for nothing. It's all going to come crumbling down.
What are we going to do without Microsoft and Xbox?
Before we even get into this, that's my personal take on this, is that people are overreacting. It's a horrible situation, for sure. But yes. If you remember when Redfall came out and everyone's like, oh my god, this is the end of Microsoft. Holy crap. You know, they better have a good game come out after this or else they're done. It's like, no, they're fine. You know, this is not
and then
the
they
end.
Did have a good game come out.
Starfield? And
guess what happened? I was thinking Hi-Fi Rush, yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, this is bad news, but Microsoft closes Redfall developer Arkane Austin, Hi-Fi Rush developer Tango Gameworks, and more. And devastating cuts at Bethesda, IGN. Redfall maker Arkane Austin. As we just mentioned, Redfall was kind of a disastrous launch. Horrible reviews. I remember Phil Spencer coming on, kind of funny.
The podcast, yeah.
The podcast there, and basically just being like, you know, we screwed up.
Yeah,
we're sorry. You know, and he was very like kind of candid in his response to them releasing that game. I think they kind of promised to fix it, but it seems like they've now abandoned that because they're shutting down the studio.
And you know what's wild? I saw some stuff on Twitter that somebody had posted like update logs or something, like internal stuff had been leaked, and people were working on the DLC or like patch
the
content,
the heroes
for Redfall the morning of that announcement.
Yeah,
so they didn't know until the day of.
It doesn't instill a lot of confidence in Microsoft. When they kind of have this poor launch, people pre-ordered the $100 edition to get like additional characters or whatever, however much it costs.
We were just talking about that last podcast.
Yeah. And if they were working on it, like to make right by those customers, that kind of sucks. That really sucks. They did say they're going to offer some sort of make a good offer for those who bought the Hero DLC, but what can they offer them? A couple of months of Game Pass? Like what? What are they going to offer them?
I know that the actual devs are reimbursing people.
That makes the most sense.
They were reimbursing. They were just like, it wasn't through Microsoft. It was through Arkane. They're working on a system, last I heard, and this is all information that was fed to me throughout the week by unconfirmed sources, but word of mouth kind of thing. People saying that they were working on a system to make sure that people get reimbursed for it, and then it wasn't even something you'd have to opt into, like you didn't have to request it was going to be credited to your account or something like that. So they're at least, the devs are at least trying to like make the best of the situation for the consumer in light of the position they've been put into right by Microsoft.
I'm curious though if they have the authority or ability to do refunds like that, because that's usually through the publisher, right?
Anyway, speculation, unconfirmed.
Hi-Fi Rush, this was the really surprising one because of how big of a hit, at least from what we could tell, Hi-Fi Rush was.
That game fucking rocks. Like, no pun intended. Like, it's genuinely such a clever... It's like, it's not perfect. Like, as I was playing through it on stream, like, there were some things that I was like, I feel like this should have been like this or that, or...
Yeah.
Like, you can unlock abilities as you go through the game, but, like, some combos are just so good, you're kind of de-incentivized from unlocking, like, 10 combos when you can just memorize two.
Right.
Unless you're the kind of player that likes to use one of everything, but overall, such a fun game. Holy crap. So good.
And It was one of the bright spots in Microsoft's like recent portfolio of games.
Seriously, yeah.
It won awards. I think it won a BAFTA, if I'm not mistaken.
Dang, didn't know that.
People were worried about it not performing well, and someone from Xbox actually clarified and said they said that it won, or it was successful on all their measures, you know, in terms of popularity, in terms of sales, wow, in terms of monetary, and yet they still shut down this developer. And it's a Japanese developer, and Microsoft always struggles with Japanese selling their games and consoles in the Japanese market, and they shut down their like one Japanese studio that made a good game. Some people have said is a game of the year contender. So
a lot of people were seeing the news and saying like all Microsoft has done now is shown that you can have like a breakout like smash hit success, and it's still not good enough.
Yeah.
And they're very concerned that it's going to lead the way for other publishers to do something similar. But
do you know Alana Pierce at all? Do you follow her at all?
Yep.
She put out a pretty good video where she was talking about it, and she made a strong point of the quality of the game does not matter.
Yeah.
And basically what really matters is, can you have sustainable and increasing sales growth, basically?
Yeah, which is not dissimilar to what Matt was saying, right? Like about having, do you have a franchise?
Right. And I mean, they could have expanded that. I don't know, but that takes more work.
I read something online offhandedly one time, so who knows if there's any truth to it, but I was pretty sure that I read that Tango was working on something. Like, I don't know. That's, if it was a sequel.
Hi-Fi Rush sequel. Yeah.
Yeah.
I read that too.
Yeah.
And good.
No, I just said, man, like,
oh, but another point that, Alana Pierce made, cause one of the big kind of controversies that cropped up at WB was Hogwarts Legacy super successful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, super successful single player one and done game. They don't even have DLC for it or expansions planned at all. It was a one and done super successful game. Then you have Suicide Squad on the other end, a live service game that was meant to go on, had season passes, was online co-op, and they potentially lost $200 million on that game, right? and what their statement was, we want to invest more in live service games. So looking at that, you're like, that doesn't make sense. Why wouldn't they invest more? And the point Alana Pierce made was that the risk is greater with a single player failure
than the reward is
with a successful live service game. So you're taking a better risk with a live service game, whether it fails or succeeds, right?
Yeah. Like the logic is there. Like the business, 100% like sociopathic business logic is there.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunately the way they're looking at it.
Yeah. So even though they Suicide Squad was a major failure for them, they think, okay, what do we have to do to make it work next time? You know, how do we make a live service game actually sell next time?
Yeah.
And if you can't do it with a DC property, you know, from a developer that everyone loves, if you can't do it with that, I don't know what you're going to do.
Yeah. It's true. So. Oh.
Yeah. Alpha Dog Games, maker of mobile game Mighty Doom, will also close. Roundhouse Studios will be absorbed by The Elder Scrolls Online, a live service game. Microsoft currently valued at over $3 trillion. I believe they are still the biggest company in the world. They overtook Apple like a month or so ago.
Oh, wow.
They did not say how many staff will lose their jobs, but significant layoffs are inevitable. Then I said, they're offering a make-good offer for those who bought Redfall. In a series of tweets, Arkane, I believe Leon, Chief Dinga Bakaba, hit out at the cuts, calling them absolutely terrible. And quote, to any executive reading this, friendly reminder that video games are an entertainment/cultural industry, and your business as a corporation is to take care of your artists/entertainers and help them create value for you. Don't throw us into gold fever gambits. Don't use us as strawmen for miscalculations/blind spots. Don't make our work environments Darwinist jungles. You say we make you proud when we make a good game. Make us proud when times are tough. We know you can. We've seen it before. So that's, I don't believe that studio was affected. So he was speaking out despite, you know, being one of the studios that survived.
Solidarity. Yeah.
Yeah. Damn.
Not mincing words.
And potentially risking your job, too. I mean,
that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, so
yeah,
it's pretty crazy.
But you know what? They know that, and they still said it. So
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Props to them for having the cojones to do so.
The question going forward: where does Microsoft go from here? And How what's your current feelings towards Microsoft?
I'm very frustrated. I'm really disappointed. Specifically, I think it hits harder because I played Hi-Fi Rush and I like know how good it was, know what a success story it was. Mm-hmm. And I share the same sentiment as a lot of other people. It's like, if this isn't good enough, then like you've lost so much faith in your devs. You've lost the faith of your consumer base. You've lost the faith of your developers who have no idea. I mean, the video game industry is already super tumultuous. Like, nobody ever knows if they've got a job after the game is launched and patched and stuff.
Oh, yeah, for
sure. Like, nobody knows that. But this is just an extra factor to be worried about now that, like, even if our game does well, it's not a guarantee that we're still around.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it's hard not to get all, like, doomy, like, end-stage capitalism kind of shit where it's like, all we have to ever do is appease shareholder, make number go up. And if anything inhibits that, cut it off. Slit its throat, let it die. And it's like, I guess Microsoft can't really do anything else. Like, when you're a company that big, like you just said, the biggest company in the world or the most valuable company in the world.
Yeah.
Their entire existence pivots on the stock value. Like, that's it. They're literally so big that that has to be their only priority. So I really hope that there's like a lot more of a push for lots of talent and higher quality devs going to smaller studios where the studios, it sounds a little more like risky, but it's a thing of risk poetically I would be more willing to take than at a big company, is that I would rather put my stock into a smaller project that the company might live or die on the success or failure of than to work on a game where it might be the best thing the world's ever seen and it's still not good enough for the company.
Me and Matt have been talking about this quite a bit recently, just because, you know, we constantly hear how game budgets are ballooning. Growth in terms of game consumers is not growing. Oh my God, what did my cat just knock off?
I heard a thump.
It was just some like screen cleaner. Why are game budgets ballooning? It's like, okay, where's that money going? It's probably going into the tech, most likely, right? Because the gameplay,
sure,
you don't need tens of millions of extra dollars to go into developing good gameplay, right?
Yeah.
So it's most likely the tech, the physics, the visual fidelity, the animations, you know. But why do games have to look so good? You know, can't they scale it back a bit? Do they need to be spending $200-300 million on a game? You know, or 200-300 million, I mean.
Maybe they're trying to jump too far ahead. Like, things can be better.
Arms race?
Yeah, like things can be better without pushing the envelope every time, right? Like, obviously as time goes on, people come to expect like higher and higher quality visuals from games just but because technology is advancing.
Are people expecting that?
I think to a certain extent, people are. Maybe not the majority consumer, but like the people who are like core, like gamers, just mm-hmm. have understood by this point that like game visuals do get better over time.
Mm-hmm.
Not that you necessarily need to always be playing the highest fidelity games, but just that like if you're going to have a big bombastic visual in your game, like you can't be like, this is the big vista and then have it be disappointing and graphics look like they're from 2013. That being said, if it's stylized enough, you can definitely get away with it. But if you're going for like semi-realistic visuals, then yeah, like the lighting's got to hit, the physics engine has to like work properly, like all this stuff, you know? So, but yeah, obviously as technology advances, pulling off those sorts of things are going to become less intensive because the technology is getting better. So yeah, like I feel like if we didn't try to push the envelope every time and try to push every engine to its absolute limit with like every game visually and like processor side.
I'm curious, what makes people buy games? Is it the way they look? Everyone says gameplay is king, obviously, but that's after you've bought it. What causes you to buy the game in the first place?
I think it changes depending on the person.
Right, but have they done surveys? Do they know that people take visual looks into account? Because to me, I just feel like, you know, The Last of Us is the Part 2 is a fantastic looking game, but it would have been a great game whether it looked like The Last of Us Part 1. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But would it have sold if it came out in every other game? Is this like everyone's raising their graphical fidelity, and so you have to, or else you're going to be like look like a cheap piece of crap compared to every other game, you know?
I know what you mean, right? Like you can't judge a game on gameplay when you haven't played it yet.
No.
But yeah, I think a lot of people, in the same way that you don't know a movie before you buy the ticket for it, you buy on a bet. You think I'm probably going to like this, right? Mm-hmm. And then it does happen sometimes where you buy a game and you don't like the gameplay, or it doesn't mesh with you, or it's not fun, or whatever other reason, right? And oftentimes you can get a refund in the scenarios, but I don't think people often always know when they buy a game. And the best thing that we can go off of is word of mouth and just seeing like gameplay footage and trailers, or seeing streamers or YouTubers play it and having friends talk about it. Demo is probably the best way. Not that too many games come with demos anymore, but there are definitely demos out there that you can play games before they're out. I actually just saw one today. There's like a demo for Like a Dragon Ishin was just launched on the PlayStation Store for the combat specifically. Mm. It's a combat demo, which is obviously like one of the better parts of that game. But that game came out last year, like November, I think. So like it's quite a way after launch to release a demo.
Yeah,
for your game. But I mean,
maybe they're hoping it will drive new sales or something.
It's a shame too, because it's like a pretty good game, but they definitely made the remaster like way more grindy for no reason. Story's fun though.
You know what I just thought about? I don't know if you could demo an Elder's a FromSoft game.
You definitely could. You could definitely demo a FromSoft game.
The fans know what they're in for. But imagine someone walking into like a GameStop. There's a demo for the next Elden Ring, and they're just getting their ass beat. Yeah. I'm buying that game.
Why not? Especially
getting your ass beat.
That's a particular example though, because everyone knows FromSoft games have that reputation now.
But demos are for people Souls, who don't know what sure. they're in for. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yes and no. It's people who were going to buy the game anyway have a chance to play it early. Like that was always the thing with Monster Hunter. Like they would always on the 3DS games anyway, they would release a demo of like three hunts before the games came out, like a month or two early. And they did it on the Switch too for Rise. I don't know if they did it for World, but that was always downloaded by people who had already played Monster Hunter. Like they're just, and they know that too. Like when they would put out the like super hard demo hunt and you have limited gear and you're kind of using underleveled gear to fight a really hard monster that you would normally have good gear for. Mm-hmm. And that's for the hardcores that are like the freaking speedrunners that know the games in and out. Right.
Yeah.
It's funny that you used like FromSoft as an example, because when I was working at, or before I was working at the game store, I went into an EB Games and the Sony rep had brought a PlayStation, a PS4 and a TV, and they'd set up on the front counter Dark Souls 3 before it came out. And the guy in the store and the demo guy were like trying to fight the first boss of Dark Souls 3. And I was just kind of watching them do it, and they were really struggling and stuff. And they were like, "Do you want to give it a try?" And I was like, "Oh yeah, you know, sure." Like I played Dark Souls,
yeah.
And I beat him first try. And they were like, "Oh my god, like this dude knows how to play Dark Souls." I was like, "Yeah, the first game is one of my favorite games of all time."
Oh jeez,
like, that was cool. It was just one of those things where like when you know what you're getting into, it's a lot easier, right? Yeah. But
before we move on, I do want to get Xbox's kind of response to this.
Okay.
This is just one, and I don't think it was really it was kind of off the cuff response, so take it with what you will. This was from Sarah Bond, the president of Xbox. She appeared at a Bloomberg interview, and they asked her about it, and this is being brought to us by Windows Central. So she was asked, "I know you're not the studio's chief, but how should gamers understand that move in terms of Microsoft's commitment to developing innovative exclusive games?" And her response was, "You know, it's always extraordinarily hard when you have to make decisions like that. You know, I'll go back to what I was saying about the industry. And when we looked at those fundamental trends, we feel a deep responsibility to ensure that the games we make, the devices we build, that the services that we offer are there through moments even when the industry isn't growing. And when you're through a time of transition. And the news we announced earlier this week is an outcome of that, and our commitments to make sure that the business is healthy for the long term. But that said, our commitment to having our own studios and working with partners to have games large and small. You know, we're a platform where you can play GTA, but you can also play Power World, where you can play Call of Duty, and you can also play Pentiment. That doesn't change. And frankly, our commitment to Bethesda and the role that it plays is part of Xbox and everything we do. So I don't know how you want to interpret that. I don't think she addressed it directly.
It's kind of a non-answer at the same time.
Yeah, it's like we have a commitment to games large and small, just not the studios that we just fired. We don't have a commitment to them, you know?
And that's what I mean. Like, it's the double, it's like the, what's the phrase? The offering the piece with one hand and slapping with the other hand. Like,
yeah,
it's so obviously like hypocritical. It's a very hard time to have any faith in Microsoft Game Studios right now.
It's weird because like we've constantly been hearing about them building their first party lineup, you know, how they're trying to work their way up to kind of be more like Sony, where they have these amazing. You watch my cat back there? Can you see my cat? Breaking into my freaking
cabinet
yeah. There. She's gone. God, she's. I might have to go get her out of there if she gets stuck in there.
Ah, cats can push open a door. It's fine.
She just recently learned how to open doors, so she might be stuck. But anyway, we just haven't seen that kind of output from them having a lot of great games, single player or first party games being released, you know. And so that's what was weird about Hi-Fi Rush. The one kind of golden egg they had, they just kind of tossed away, you know.
Yeah. But all right. Like we've discussed, right? They just have different priorities.
Yeah, and I guess what her point was is that they for some reason, whatever their calculus was in their meetings, they had to get rid of these studios so they could build a better future of Xbox, you know.
Build a better live service platform churning machine.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to our next story. Switch 2 finally got officially kind of announced.
Officially, sort of, kind of, yeah.
Yeah. They said it will be revealed before April 2025. Promises, Nintendo. This is from The Verge. Nintendo has thrown Switch players a long-awaited bone alongside announcing its end-of-the-year financial results, confirming the console's successor will be unveiled before April 2025. Nintendo president Shintaro Furukawa said that a next-generation Nintendo Switch console will be announced within the fiscal year, giving the Japanese game giant a deadline of March 31st, 2025. I mean, it's inevitable, right?
Of course, yeah.
I'm curious why they decided to like announce it in a earnings call, maybe to give investors
kind of heads up,
or like to get them excited to invest in Nintendo stock.
Yeah, yep.
We got another Switch coming because like Switch sales, I think, while still doing well, are projected to go down just because the console's been out. What has it been? 9 years?
Am I correct in that? 2017, so like 7 years.
2017, is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I was in college.
You were in college in 2017?
Yeah.
What?
I went back a couple of times. I was in and out of college for like...
Oh, okay.
6 years or something.
I was like, I was in college like 10 years ago.
Yeah. So was I. And then I wasn't.
Yeah.
Then I worked for a while. And then I went to college again.
2017. Yeah. Okay. Trust but verify. Sorry, Tim.
I don't see how it is. Don't believe my word. It's fine. Verify information. Don't just accept info from one source. It's fair.
Yeah. Oh, I think what the 9 years was is in 2025, right? No, that's wrong too. Where did I get 9 years from?
I don't know.
All right, maybe I'm just crazy. All right, well,
talking about
interesting that they kind of said a Switch. Did they say successor?
What was the? I remember seeing the tweet.
Oh, this is so we will make an announcement about a successor.
Yeah.
Nintendo Switch within this fiscal year. It will have been over 9 years. There we go. Since we announced the existence.
Since they first announced it. Yeah. That's what it is.
Of the Nintendo Switch back in March 2015. We'll be holding a Nintendo Direct this June regarding the Nintendo Switch software lineup for the later half of 2024, but please be aware that there will be no mention of the Nintendo Switch successor during that presentation. So that isn't necessarily a Switch 2.
No.
It's a successor to the Switch.
Yeah, so it could be not a Switch. It could be just an actual dedicated home-only console.
Although I think that would be kind of insane at this point.
It'd be very weird for Nintendo to do so because like the Switch, I mean, I've said it on the show before, but like it's genuinely like the spirit of Nintendo distilled into a console. Like it's exactly the kind of thing that Nintendo should have made, and they made it at exactly the right
time. And genius to combine like their DS, Game Boy kind of mobile and their home consoles, like a genius move. And you always want to be the one to cannibalize your own products. So the shed no tears over the loss of the DS because they're the ones who killed it, you know, and brought a better console, you know, arguably. So,
yep. As much as I do miss my like 3DS and DS or Game Boy Advance SP and all that, it's like the Switch was a good successor though.
Yeah. So yeah, I definitely think it will be like and it spawned a whole industry of handheld gaming devices, you know, so they definitely probably want to keep being a part of that. I would imagine maybe it won't be called the Switch, but that's also a good name too. I just think Nintendo Switch, it just seems good to me.
I remember seeing the trailer for the first time and going, Switch, what the hell? And then like, but yeah, it grows on you.
Mm-hmm. I saw someone say the Switch U.
yeah, it's the obvious joke, but it's still funny.
Yeah. Now the question is, do I buy it? I've bought a lot of Nintendo consoles that I've played like twice.
Yeah, buy it right now.
Well, I have the Tears of the Kingdom console, and I've never even completed Breath of the Wild.
I mean, it is a gorgeous system, though.
It was gorgeous. I couldn't help it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I had to have it like just as like a big Zelda fan, but like. I also was kind of wondering about getting an OLED Switch anyway, and
OLED's nice. That alone is almost worth the update.
Noticeably different,
Noticeably, yeah, for sure. So for this, I'm kind of just guessing probably better hardware. There was rumors of magnetic Joy-Cons. Now, that will be strong enough? I don't know.
Yeah,
it will probably still have something to stop it from just like flying off, and there goes your expensive OLED display.
Oh no!
It's getting down the sidewalk, yeah. But more power, I think, for sure. That is a pretty old processor. If they announced it back in 2015,
yeah,
that means they were already developing with it.
Right?
Well, I think it's using like the NVIDIA Shield processor. Do you remember the NVIDIA Shield? Yeah,
yep.
And that was ancient by the time that even came out. So, so we'll see what they do there. But they have some competition now, though, with the Steam Deck and such. So we'll see how good a sequel does there. Exciting times, though. I'm actually excited for it because they always do something cool. So.
It's one of those things that like people have been talking about it for so long.
Yeah.
That, like every time you see some like announcement or whatever, you're always like, okay, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But then this is actually like from Nintendo specifically. So it's like, oh no, this is legit. Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's move on to a very, very last story of the week. Some more bad news.
Oh,
EA is considering in-game ads. This is from Kotaku. So news of this came from the company's May 7th earnings call, in which EA CEO Andrew Wilson was asked about dynamic ad insertion within AAA games, and if he thought this was a possible source of cash flow for the company. Wilson said EA sees advertising as a possible, meaningful driver of growth, but wants to be thoughtful about how ads could be implemented into its games. Generally, how do you feel about ads in games?
I mean, it's not a new concept.
No.
There were ads in that one NBA game, like, number of years ago, and the load screens were like ads.
And do I remember Rainbow Six Vegas or something like that, or one of the Rainbow Six games? There might have been ads.
Rainbow Six Vegas 2 had the MLG map that had like ads, like from sponsors all over the like walls and the environment and stuff. But yeah, and then like we talked about, I think Matt said something about like a Mercenaries game had like a billboard for something at the time,
something like that. Yeah,
like we've talked about it before. It's again like. It's hard not to be like doomer, you know, late stage capitalism where it's like you've bought the product, but it's still not enough money. You still need to keep paying for this product. Like how long before it's normalized that you buy a game and you have to buy a subscription in that game to get the ad free version of that game, or like pay an extra $5 at launch for the game to get the ad free version of the game. Like if they're going to do it, I think for as, you know, dystopian a concept as it is to add ads to a game you've already paid full price for. The NBA game did it in the right way. It was a loading screen anyway. So like if you're going to be waiting, sure, play an ad, you know, but, we got SSDs, man, like games load fast.
my problem is the paying for it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But it's just like everything you pay for streaming services now, and now streaming services have ads too.
I mean, yeah, it happened famously to cable. It's going to happen to any kind of subscription service, obviously, because you're right. The endless need to make more money, and they always start off these subscriptions at like introductory prices to get as many sign-ons, because they know you're less likely to leave if the value's there, or if the content you want's there.
Yeah, sunken cost fallacy. You've already invested into it, so you can't quit now.
I don't have as big of a deal if it's a free-to-play game. If Fortnite wanted to throw some ad in the corner of the map selecting screen, you know, it's like, okay, I don't like it, but what am I going to do? However, I do want the option to pay to get rid of it. So let's say I even purchased a $90 Canadian game, right? And there's an ad on it. And they say, remove all ads for an extra $10 or whatever. I'd be happy to actually do that. It would hurt me, and I know it hurts a lot of people for hearing me say that, but I just don't like ads. And that would actually pay to get rid of them.
You're the one who's falling for it, though. You're playing it in their hand.
But the point is, if the game at $90 is not enough for them to make money, right? And they're not willing to raise the price so that it makes money, then let me pay to get rid of the ad. I will pay the extra price if I need to. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
I just don't like ads. I hate ads.
It's like, you hate to set the precedent, but like, I know what you mean.
Yeah, I don't want this to happen. I don't. I really don't. But
you're getting out your wallet. I'm not. I don't endorse this. Yeah.
Yeah. Like Amazon Prime or Prime Video just added ads to all accounts. And then you have to pay an additional like couple bucks or whatever it is to remove ads. I haven't done it yet because it has not become annoying yet. And I don't watch too much Prime videos yet.
Right.
But when The Boys comes out in June, I might have an issue there. Thankfully, Fallout, whatever that, I can't remember the brand that was paying for that.
Fizz Mobile. Yeah.
They paid for no ads during the show. And that was, I'm not too upset about that. That
good guy, Fizz. Yeah.
Good on them for doing that. Yeah. I like how it's EA doing this, though. EA, who had the reputation of being a scumbaggy kind of company, one worst company on the planet.
EA,
which is so stupid.
I think, actually, let me pull something up. I just read something on Twitter before we started recording. There's something about an article, somebody in EA, game developer reported, EA boss thinks ads and AAA games would be a meaningful growth driver. So having AI generated content in game development is obviously like going to happen in the future. We know it is. But doing it in an ethical way is, I think, going to be the hinging point. I saw a different article.
Speaking of AI like being used for development, though, is it that bad if they're like, we need you to design a bunch of NPCs that just walk the streets of New York? Is it really that bad to like use AI to generate those NPCs?
No, inherently, you're not
taking away jobs, you know, really.
It's fine to, I think ethically, it's fine if you're going to use AI generation to
fast track.
Like to do busy work, I think it's fine. And if you're sort of like training the AI model on your own stuff, like if Bethesda was using it to like populate a city, like you say, right? And they're training the AI model on their own existing NPCs and they're not stealing art assets from like other stuff off the internet to like make billboards or make clothing designs for NPCs and stuff like that. Like,
yeah,
I think that there is an ethical way to do it. I don't think companies are concerned about the ethics at all right now.
I don't like the idea of generating voices for games because that will directly take away, you know, jobs that from takes voice actors.
Jobs away from voice actors. And you're also like, as a voice actor, you are consenting to allow that content to be like your voice being used to say things, which has obviously like a social angle to it, where if you're using an AI generated voice to that you've trained off of like off of a character in Skyrim, one of the Skyrim voice actors, and now you're having that character say anything, the person who recorded those original lines did not sign any paperwork like releasing, you know, the company from like, oh yeah, I'm fine with my voice being used to have this character say this thing. But if you train like an AI voice model off of like the guy who did Jarl Balgruuf's voice in Whiterun to start saying like anti-Semitic shit or like super far right stuff or like, you know, pro terrorist type things, like it's obviously very problematic in the real world because now it's like, oh, he said all this stuff and it's like, I didn't, they just trained a voice model off of me and it's AI generated dialogue, right?
How do you generate an original voice? I don't know what the other like whatever Google's assistant is or something, but Siri originally was generated off of a human woman, voice yep. actress.
She's on TikTok, I think.
Oh yeah, yeah. Doing oh yeah, she does like she does her Siri voice and stuff. Yeah. So, but how do you generate from scratch an original voice? Now, obviously, human voices probably repeat. Everyone, you know, oh, you sound like that person. You sound like this person.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it repeats, but I mean, you have to have some basis from something.
I same can't with, same looks. I don't same know. Looks yeah. Yeah, I get it all the time. You look like this person, look like that person.
Yeah. All right. That's it for the news.
Bright, sunny, sunshine episode this week.
Well, I mean, yeah.
But that's the state of it.
Since you're the only person here, what are you playing, Tim?
I just actually finished playing in the light of the show. I jumped on the bandwagon. I was playing Fallout New Vegas again.
Oh, yeah.
Finish it off in what was the most chaotic playthrough of New Vegas I've ever had. I got an ending I didn't even know was possible. And that's always fun when you're playing through the game again. I did a lot of, I was like kind of playing both sides until at the like point of like ending the game. Like I played Caesar's Legion all the way up to the end of like Caesar's Legion playthrough and then dumped them and then went back to the strip and started like doing everything for the sort of independent ending with Yes Man that Benny was trying to do. And that kind of made for an interesting interaction at the end of the game where, if you're familiar with New Vegas, you go to the Battle of Hoover Dam, you cross the dam to go to the Caesar's like legate's camp, and Legate Linnaeus is there. And you can do this whole interaction with him. There's a bunch of different ways that you can get through that interaction, whether it's speech or barter or just fighting him. But when I went there, he, even though I didn't start the fight allied with Caesar's Legion, and by the time I started that fight, I was actually vilified with Caesar's Legion after helping them all the way through because I went to the fort and I killed everybody. He still thought I was his ally. Like I'd fought towards that camp the whole time, fighting Caesar's Legion on behalf of an independent Vegas with like the Securitrons with me and stuff. And I went up to talk with him for like the final encounter, up walking up that hill, and he starts talking to me as if he's like commanding me around. He's like, "You'll go down there and you'll teach the NCR like all this and that, blah blah blah." And I was like, my only speech options were like, "Yes, sir, I'll do what you say," and like be right back and stuff. And I was like, uh-oh, did I like glitch the game out? Like it thinks it's doing one ending, but I'm doing a different ending. So he turns around, he starts walking back up the hill, pull up my katana, start slicing the shit out of him, turns into the fight, kill him real quick. I get the quest update for like dealing with Legate Linnaeus, take his helmet, take his sword, go back down the hill. The NCR is there at the gate. And then I do the whole like kind of ending for an independent Vegas. And I guess this is kind of like a spoiler for the 14-year-old game. Normally, when you do the independent ending, you go to the fort and go to the bunker under Caesar's camp and like activate the hidden Securitron army that's there in the vault. Mm-hmm. So you have just like hundreds of Securitrons at your disposal. And then also you have the platinum chip to upgrade the Securitrons to version 2.0. Mm-hmm. And so you just like dominate the wasteland with this massive army of robots, which is like a super cool ending. And it's often the one that I go with when I play through the game. Part of Caesar's storyline is to go down into the vault. Caesar gives you the platinum chip and he says, blow the vault up. And so I was like, well, I'm trying to help out Caesar's Legion to a point. So, okay. So I destroyed the Securitron army and then went back to Yes Man later at the end of the game. And I was like, I blew it up. And he's like, oh, great. You destroyed the army in the vault. The whole thing that this plan was hinging on. And you destroyed it. That's okay. I'm sure you had a good reason to do it. And so that part is kind of what this kind of secret ending hinges on, is that when you go back down the hill and then, you know, General Oliver of the NCR shows up and you kind of are like swinging your dick around being like, I've got this massive Securitron army. NCR can't do shit. You're going to leave the wasteland or I'm going to blow you all up. And he's like, oh, okay, like, sure. And then Yes Man rolls up and he's like, when I was rooting around in Mr. House's old files, I found some sort of like, you know, programming routine where I can reprogram my own personality to be more assertive. So I'm going to go do that. I'm probably never going to see you again. The strip is mine. See you later. And so Yes Man takes it for himself. And right. I was like, what? That's so friggin' cool. And that's like got to be an ending that not a lot of people have seen. So And then that slideshow at the end where it's like, this happened here, this happened here, this happened here. I like had screwed over so many people in this playthrough because the entire point of the playthrough, I was just trying to get this this one perk that is a perk that you can get if you have the cannibal perk, which is called Meat of Champions, where you have to eat Mr. House, the King in Freeside, Caesar,
eat them,
and President Kimball. You have to cannibalize them. They're dead bodies. God. And if you do that, then it gives you a perk that's actually kind of bad for how hard it is to do that challenge, mm-hmm. where for a minute after you cannibalize a corpse, you gain +1 to charisma, strength, intelligence, and luck for a minute. So it's like not very helpful.
No, jeez.
But yeah, it's just kind of like a secret thing. And that was the entire point of that playthrough. So it made for a ridiculous ending.
Wow.
But yeah. But then since then I have started playing a trilogy that I played the first one, and I have the other two games and I never played them, so my idea now is to play through the whole trilogy, and that is the reboot of the Tomb Raider series.
Hey, that's exciting.
So I played the first Tomb Raider over 10 years ago now. Last time I played it, booted up on Steam, was like June of 2013. I really like that game. I always cite that game as being one of very few games where I played it, beat the story, enjoyed it so much that I immediately started another save file right after beating it and playing it again. And
we talking the original?
No, 2013
reboot. Okay,
reboot, Square Enix reboot.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Of Tomb Raider. That game, the gameplay wise, that game holds up. It's still really, really fun. The graphics look kind of bad. I'm playing the like definitive edition, air quotes, which is like you can buy different versions of it on console, but I think they patched the Steam version. Just like Tomb Raider just got the definitive edition upgrade, so it's they added the like dynamic effects physics something for her hair. Mm-hmm. So she has better hair. All the models are like higher resolution. There's lots of like stupid stuff in that game where like no matter all the shit that they put Lara through in that first game, her makeup and hair is always perfect. It's the Tomb Raider games are always kind of fantastical and goofy.
She fights dinosaurs. Like, I mean,
she fights dinosaurs. She fights mythical Japanese weather spirit things. Yeah. Queens. It's a whole thing. That first game still kind of kicks ass, honestly, and it's fun to be playing it again.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to play Rise of the Tomb Raider and Shadow of the Tomb Raider afterwards.
I love all three. I've replayed the first one maybe like 4 times.
Oh wow.
Damn. Yeah. When I first built my very first gaming PC, I replayed it because I just wanted to try it out.
Compare it. See how well it ran.
And Shadow of the Tomb Raider is like still to this day used as a benchmark for gaming PCs just because of how kind of gorgeous that game is.
Damn.
And it's kind of sad that it's kind of in limbo. They've announced another game that's going to connect these games with the original game somehow. I think that's a bit messy myself.
Yeah.
I think just start over, you know, keep going forward with what we're doing. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of sad that there's not a close game on the horizon. There is one way out there, but can't see it yet. But yeah, I'm excited. They're going to be playing through those. That's awesome. Did you play them on Game Pass, or where did you say you're getting them? On Steam?
I had them on Steam. I must have bought them like on some sale a long time ago.
Yeah.
Back when I was in the habit of, that game's on sale, I'll play it eventually. I'll buy it now instead of just waiting till I was actually going to play it.
Yeah.
Because like you say, right, they're all on Game Pass. Like I could have played them for
they do free, go, but part of the They do go cheap as well. And they did leave Game Pass. I think they just came back.
Okay.
But they go cheap as well on Steam and even on PlayStation and stuff. A friend of mine just got a PS5. She's a big Tomb Raider fan. And I recently texted her because there was a sale going on. And she got them all for like $20 or $30. Uh-huh. You know? Uh-huh. So I'm excited. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's going to be good. But that's largely my week. I also, right after finishing playing New Vegas, kind of while I was playing it on stream, I was made aware of the Viva New Vegas mod project, which is basically like a big overhaul to really modernize it and first of all, like stabilize the game and make it a lot more or a lot less crash prone and a lot better performance wise. But then there's also sort of a collection of mods for making it feel more like a modern shooter, more like a modern Fallout, and add some quality of life features and things to it.
Yeah.
As well as adjusting like the world balance and things. And so I was thinking like I was halfway through my playthrough at this point and I was like, I don't want to try to install this mod pack and then keep going with an existing save file, because that's probably going to be really messy. But I finished off that playthrough and I kept thinking about it, and I was like, maybe I should see like how big of an endeavor this would be to try to get this mod going, this mod project, this pack. And just a couple of nights this week, I just sat down and for a couple hours at a time, I was like downloading mods, and I was, you know, like fiddling with game install folders and files and things, and eventually got it all going. And when all said and done, it's 118 files that I downloaded through for a mod manager, and some were more manual install than others. But the Viva New Vegas project has a really solid write up on their website for step by step instructions on how to do it. And it was really one of those moments where I was like, I go to boot it up for the first time and I'm really holding my breath, because I was like, I just installed 65 mods for like performance and making sure like things are going to like run better. If this game doesn't boot up and I don't have like a crash log, I have no idea what I'm going to do. I'll probably just give up. But apparently they have a Discord specifically for the project as well that is super, super good. Like I have an acquaintance of mine was saying that they also downloaded the same mod pack, like mod project, and they had a couple of hiccups, and they joined the Discord and they got responses for their questions like super quick. So people are really passionate about it, which is cool. And I've been playing it a little bit over the last couple of days, a little bit here and there. And I gotta say, it's impressive how much it keeps the core feel of Fallout New Vegas, but adds like modern things, like more modern scopes for guns, like not that the scope itself is like modern military, but just the like the way they portray a scope in a video game.
Yeah,
it's not just like a black screen with the like the visual circle in the middle with like the crosshair on it. Like it's like a scope, it's you're like looking down iron sight, and then it has a zoomed in center of the screen that's the scope. Yeah. With like the model of the scope around it, and it just makes the game like look that much nicer, you know. And then it's things obviously including like higher resolution graphics and better fidelity for like lighting and weather effects, and higher quality like audio, and just a lot of quality of life features that don't change the core gameplay of the game, but just make everything just that little bit nicer, a little bit more modern. And as well, like adding more NPCs to locations to make parts of the cities feel more fleshed out. And like, there's not just 8 NPCs walking around the strip. Now there's like 40. So it actually feels like you're in Vegas in a casino, walking around an empty casino on the strip. Just stuff like that. So it's been a lot of fun. I've been really relishing my time with it, and it's going to be very hard to ever play New Vegas without it.
Oh, honestly. Go back and play vanilla
on the Xbox 360 version 1.0.
Do it. You know what I was disappointed about? So like Fallout is like really hot right now.
Very
and
hot.
It's like Fallout 4 is like sold out across the planet.
Oh really? Like used copies are sold out everywhere?
Yeah.
Cool.
And like I think maybe like I was thinking like used copies on eBay would have skyrocketed. I went and looked up like how much the collector's edition of New Vegas was going for. Because I own that.
Yeah.
And it wasn't going up that much. It wasn't worth that much. And I was like, why not?
I was going to say it's on my shelf right over there.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that thing. And the platinum chip. They miss an opportunity, a real opportunity to have that platinum chip like come apart in half and just have it be like a little 1 gig flash drive.
With what on it? Just
doesn't need to be anything. Just make it a flash drive. That's what it is in the game.
Yeah. That's true.
Extra production cost.
It would have been a coin.
It would have been. It would have been. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. All right, for me, not too much on my end. I did play a bit of Fallout 3, but I haven't been playing a lot lately. Because I've been playing 76 now. And so I'm getting my Fallout fill there rather than with Fallout 3.
Mm-hmm.
Fallout is it's pretty decent now. I just saw that IGN updated their review. When the game launched, they gave it a 5 out of 10. It's now up to a 7 out of 10.
76?
Yeah. So
not bad.
It's an okay game.
I mean, 7 out of 10 is good. Like, I really, I don't need to get into it, but
I know, yeah.
It's such a sliding scale of what's considered, like, acceptable. Like, people look at a 5 out of 10, and they'll be like, it's a fucking piece of garbage. It's shit. It's completely unplayable. It's like, no, that would be, like, a 1 or a 2. A 5 is like, take it or leave it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's because of like how schools view like a grading scale, where like a fail is like a like 60? Less than a 60.
Yeah.
In some places like a 70. Mm-hmm. If you get like a 69, it's a fail, but a 70 is a pass. So it gives people this like skewed sense of what's considered good and acceptable.
Yeah. But man. Also, I think it's just funny how, well, it's the games are expensive. That's probably part of the problem. When something's expensive, you want it to be good.
Understandably. Like, yeah. Yeah.
You buy a toaster. If it's a 5 out of 10, it's fine. You know, I'm not going to be angry about it. You know, it costs $30. I mean,
it's a toaster. It doesn't need to be a 10 out of 10 toaster.
Yeah.
Although if you knew somebody who had a 10 out of 10 toaster, you'd be like, where the hell did you get that toaster? Because I need me a 10 out of 10 toaster.
Yeah.
Toast it perfect every time. Straight out of the fridge. Still cold. Perfectly toasted.
Yeah.
Right there on the counter. Still perfectly toasted. Frozen bread. Toasted.
Yeah. And then just like Overwatch, Fortnite has kind of fallen away because both Overwatch and Fallout 76 are live service games. You can only have two in your life, I find. and even that is kind of hard to keep up with. So, I got back to Helldivers a bit. Me and Aaron have been playing again. Not too much, but I've been hopping back in there and stuff and whatnot. And just on a kind of a side note, I pre-ordered the new iPad Pro. Mm-hmm. And I think... Assassin's Creed Mirage is coming out for iOS in June.
Mm.
And I think I'm going to try to play it on there.
It's the first Assassin's Creed game in like 10 years I've been tempted to play.
Mirage?
Yeah.
It's like $20 right now on Ubisoft Store.
Oh,
yeah. You can use like a discount code. It's already like 40 or 50% off. And then you use like a discount code for an additional 10% off. It's like $20. So maybe grab that before it's gone. But you might be able to find it cheaper if you wait longer.
But. Yeah, true.
Or we'll show up on Game Pass or something.
Yeah, eventually, yeah.
All right, that's it. That's all I've been playing. That.
Hell yeah. Good week for games. Bad week for the industry. Really bad. Real bad. Precedent being set.
Maybe. Yeah, it was a sad, sad week.
Yeah, very disappointing.
All right, where can they watch you play games happily?
If you are keen on watching somebody happily play the Tomb Raider series, the reboot, Squeenix
version. Have you started that yet?
Yeah, I was playing it
I missed the start.
Wednesday and Friday.
All right, yeah, I'm gonna tune in on Monday then.
Oh, hell yeah. Keep it going. Twitch.tv/thesidetrack, where we are always getting distracted. And it's very true in this game too. I'm going down like every side path being like, ooh, yellow box of scrap. Ooh, box of scrap. Ooh, box of scrap. But all my weapons are like fully upgraded and I'm like halfway through the game. So there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, there's lots of features of that game that I really have aged well, and I like how that game works, but especially how they sort of encourage you to go back to previous areas once you have new like mechanical like gameplay options unlocks, but they don't force it down your throat. Like there's that part of the game where the plane crashes in the storm,
yeah.
And it changes the layout of a previous area that you've been to before, but the game doesn't make you go back there. It hardly even shows off that the plane is there, and so mm-hmm. I was near there looking down, and I was like, motherfucker, they have this crashed plane here now, and they didn't even show it to me. Like, a modern AAA game now would be like, look at this thing that we changed. You gotta go back there, and you gotta spend 4 hours in this area. The game's like, yeah, it's there. You can go back if you want to. I don't care. I think you notice it. I mean,
yeah.
So there's lots of stuff that's just kind of like little touches here and there. And I'm like, for 2013, this game had some stuff going on.
Oh, hell yeah.
It's a good game. Awesome. But yeah, twitch.tv/thesidetrack, 5 days a week, usually. Around 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. And then occasionally you and I and Matt on Wednesday nights.
On twitch.tv/dayonepatchmedia, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Potentially playing Halo ODST.
ODST. Fucks with some ODST. I love that game. And you said you've never played it or you never beat it?
I think I have, because I was trying to make my way through all the Halo games, and that was on my list of ones I have not played.
Right.
And so I think I started it, but I don't think I got more than like half an hour in it.
Maybe Matt
so.
Said he's never played it.
Matt, I think Matt said he was the one who suggested it because he never played it, right?
Yeah. The thing about ODST is that like it's fine. Like I played it and I beat it alone. I played it solo back in the 360 days, but it's meant to be multiplayer.
Because
it's not like Halo 2 where like you're Master Chief and Arbiter. Or Master Chief and then you have like another character or Arbiter with another elite enemy.
Mm-hmm.
You're all just ODSTs. Like, you're all just soldiers. And I think it was kind of designed around four player co-op. It's a good game. It's not super long, but I liked it.
Yeah. The unfortunate part is we had to install the 130 gigs of the Master Chief Collection just to play it.
Yeah, like 26
games. I didn't even know it was in that because I thought the Master Chief Collection had the Master Chief games, not ODST.
ODST was not a standalone. It was an add-on for Halo 3, I think.
Oh, was it?
It's called
Halo 3 ODST, isn't it?
Yeah, it's called Halo 3 ODST, and it had two parts. It had the campaign, the ODST campaign on it, and it had a multiplayer map pack on another disc.
That's interesting. Okay. Yeah. Or we'll be playing Hot Wheels Unleashed.
Or Hot Wheels. Depends what you're feeling on Wednesday night.
Probably Halo. I mean, I don't have much interest in Hot Wheels Unleashed.
I've played it in a long time.
I'm not a big racing game kind of guy. So.
I'm not either, honestly, but this game, Hot Wheels, I mean, there's just something different about Hot Wheels. You can be so goofy with it, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I don't play racing games, but I like Crash Team Racing. I like Mario Kart. You know, it's the goofy kind of racing game.
Yeah. All right, that's it. Thanks for joining me, Tim.
Thanks for hosting me.
Showing up on like that Matt Lawrence.
Oh, I see how it is. Okay.
Yeah. I'm just going to be bothered.
Last 30 seconds of the podcast audio, just tearing him a new one. Man, Matt's, you know, actually.
Matt's also been on the show more than anyone. Yeah, so
Yeah.
All right.
More than the host. I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
All right. We'll see you guys next time.
Thanks for listening.
Peace.
Thank you. That was my best impression of Matt.